Chile used to be considered the economic poster child of Latin America. Economic liberalization led to huge gains in terms of GDP, life expectancy, and lifting people out of poverty. But in recent months, the country has been mired in violent protests, to which there is still no end in sight. Who's to blame? For large parts of the Western media, the answer is quite simple. The culprit is neoliberalism. The Guardian titles, "Blame the Chicago Boys," a reference to the foreign-trained economists who liberalized the Chilean economy during the Pinochet dictatorship. Open Democracy claims that this economic system has benefited the economic elites whilst creating inequality and suffering for the majority. Inevitably, there have been some nostalgic references to Chile's brief experiment with socialism in the early 1970s. The implication here being that if only that experiment had continued, Chile would be a vastly better place than it is today. Now, this of course presents us with a good opportunity for some stocktaking of the situation of a country that continues to fascinate a lot of observers and commentators on both the left and the right. How should we evaluate the situation of Chile today? Neoliberal hellhole or rags to riches success story? What explains the left's ongoing fondness for a brief socialist experiment that ended nearly half a century ago? And what might Chile look like today if the socialists had succeeded? Can free market liberals defend the legacy of the Chicago Boys with a good conscience, given that those reforms were carried out under a brutal military dictatorship? Joining me to discuss is the IEA's Dr. Christian Niemetz. Hi, Christian.
Hello.
Christian, what exactly is going on in Chile today? Set the scene for us. What are the protests? Who are they aimed at? And what do they mean? Because surely even you'll believe if there are prolonged mass protests, the situation can't be that great. Surely this means that the neoliberal project really has failed and ultimately lacks legitimacy.
Well, yeah, that's the problem. I mean, it's very hard to try to assess the political mood in a foreign country. That's why I won't try to speculate. I'll just get it wrong. But I'll say this. I've found it a bit surprising that so many commentators in the Western media seemed so sure about what exactly this is about and what the mood is like, which I'd be very reluctant to comment on as an outside observer. But to see that so many Western journalists who probably a couple of months ago wouldn't have been able to locate Chile on a map are now Chile experts, I would say that if you imagine this in reverse, imagine you had a Chilean TV crew coming here filming a protest in Westminster, let's say an anti-austerity march, and then went or interviewed a couple of activists and then went back home and said, this is the mood in Britain. This is how the typical Brit thinks. Mm-hmm. You would get a very distorted impression. You would get the impression that half of the British population are members of the Socialist Workers' Party, for a start. Mm-hmm. It's always the case that in protests, in demonstrations, you get a self-selected audience. Mm-hmm. And even then, even with that in mind, you always get a merging of several causes. You often have protests starting with something fairly narrow and specific, and then many other groups attach themselves to it. We see this here in Westminster all the time, that let's say you have a people's march, a campaign for a second EU referendum. Okay, fair enough. Then you get, within minutes, you see the first Palestinian flags. Okay, what's that got to do with the EU referendum? Then you see the Extinction Rebellion logo. Again, what's that got to do with either the Palestine issue or the EU issue? And then you get people trying to sell Trotskyite publications. And then it would be very odd for someone to try to say, okay, here's the mood. That's what this is about. In their case, it started like here with something fairly narrow and specific. It was about a rise in transport costs, public transport, mm-hmm. their underground system in Santiago de Chile. And that then became much bigger and broader, and you had other groups jumping on the bandwagon. But even The Guardian, I read an article in The Guardian about 2 weeks ago where they pointed out that some of the bigger groups within that protest movements are feminist groups, feminist campaign groups. They want a new constitution in which gender equality is recognized. Well, yeah, fair enough, but that's not an economic issue.
Yes.
And it's odd that The Guardian portrays those groups, even though they were the ones who otherwise try to portray this as purely something about economics and, well, portraying it as if every protester, it's always odd how in the way they describe it, the protesters all seem to think exactly like Guardian readers. Mm-hmm. This sounds suspiciously like projection to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and capture of a protest that might not have anything to do with what The Guardian wants it to have something to do with. Now, if we take a step back and look at the origins of Chile's successful economic model, you might not think it's a successful model, we'll come on to that. They had a military coup in 1973, which established the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. Then, a few months later, the Chicago Boys popped up. They were educated at Chicago University under Nobel Prize winner Milton Friedman, right? And started to take over the key positions of the economy, the Treasury, Business Department, and the Department of Work and Pensions. Now, who were they, Christian, and where did they suddenly come from? And then, more specifically, more importantly, what was it that they actually did?
Right. The Chicago Boys were a group of foreign-trained economists. Foreign-trained doesn't always literally mean in Chicago. Chicago refers more to a mindset than a place. Mm-hmm. But it started with the University of Chicago. They had an agreement with the Catholic University of Santiago de Chile in the 50s, where they could send people up there to study abroad, do their postgraduate degrees, the best and the brightest. And of course, Chicago University wasn't just any university. That was, at that time, the 50s, 60s, 70s, that was the mecca of free market economics. All the big names were there, Milton Friedman, Gary Becker, Arnold Harberger, all the heavyweights of free market economics, they were all there. And a lot of those exchange students picked up not just technical skills, but also that Chicago school, Chicago economics mindset. So they then went back to Chile, and it must have been, I guess, depressing for them that they came back with a fairly clear idea of how an economy should be organized, and then coming back to a country which did the exact opposite of all that, because Chile at that time, even before socialism, before Allende, it was a highly statist and interventionist economic model, and had been since the 30s. So this group, some of them just stayed in contact with each other, and some of them set up a research group of sorts. They published an economic manifesto in the early 70s. At that time, they were going nowhere. They didn't believe that a government would pick this up and say, oh, this sounds great, we'll do this. This was pie in the sky thinking at the time. They were more like a think tank, you could say. They wrote this manifesto in the early 70s during the Allende years when the economy was falling apart or starting to fall apart. And then the military got hold of that document in some way and promoted some of them to top positions gradually. It's not that they were there right from the start. That's the Naomi Klein version, trying to link neoliberal economics with a dictatorship in construing a link that in that way didn't exist. At the coup, nobody could have known that this would lead to indirectly to economic liberalization. The military had no economic philosophy as such. And in the beginning, they didn't do much. They had no agenda of their own, other than reversing what happened in the Allende years. But in the first year or so, nothing much happened other than that on the economic front. It was only about a year after the coup that one of the Chicago Boys became finance minister. I think either finance or minister of the economy, one of the two. And a year later, the other department was also taken over by a Chicago Boy. And that's when it all started. That's when they started with a much broader program of structural reforms. So one of the big things that they did was to open up the economy Chile was extremely protectionist up until then. They had very high tariffs and what's worse than that, a lot of variation in tariffs. So every product had its own tariff rate, which means you get absolutely terrible political incentives. You get incentives for lobbying. You get economic success being determined not by how good you are at keeping your customers happy, but how good you are establishing contacts with the government and pleading for special favors. That was their economic structure before. And the Chicago Boys replaced all that that chaos of loads of different tariff rates with a single flat rate tariff of 10%, which still sounds quite high, but given where they were coming from, that was a form of shock therapy. That suddenly the economy was relatively open to the world. They did that in the latter half of the 70s. So by the end of the 70s, that that 10% single tariff rate was in place. Another thing that they did was phasing out price controls. Before then, and especially under Allende, the prices of lots of things were state controlled. There was an entire government department that did nothing else and work out what different things should cost. And the Chicago Boys gradually phased all that out in the second half of the 70s. So by 1980, that was mostly gone. Prices were set by the market. You had market prices coordinating the economy. And then there was a big privatization program started just with returning companies that had been expropriated in the Allende years, but then went much further. In the late 80s, they privatized a lot of the big companies, including utilities. And that privatization program was, relative to the size of the economy, was bigger than what happened in Britain in the Thatcher years.
Well, I was about to ask that. How similar is the economic liberalization in this country compared to that happened in Chile?
Well, it started from a more extreme position.
Yes, there wasn't a dictatorship here. Although some would argue Margaret Thatcher's prime ministership was a dictatorship.
Some absolutely would and still do today.
Yeah.
I mean, Britain started from a pretty desperate position compared to Western Europe. Britain had gone much further towards the road, on the road towards socialism. Chile was much further still. So you had to start with pretty basic stuff, like just allowing market prices again, which doesn't sound particularly radical, but it's all relative. It all depends on what the starting position was. But if you look at the initial manifesto by the Chicago Boys, it doesn't sound super radical. It sounds more like a standard economics textbook. Mm-hmm. A lot of it was stuff that, let's say, Tony Blair could have said in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. But if you start from a position where the state is the main actor in economic life, it is pretty extreme. And in some ways they did go further than Thatcherism did. For example, the most radical reform was probably that they privatized the pension system entirely.
Right.
So phased out state pensions, came in with a system where everyone had a pension fund, a retirement savings account of their own, and that system is still up and running today. That was probably the single biggest reform, because that meant you now had a big increase in savings and investment, and that led to the development of capital markets. They didn't really have a financial market as such before. Most people didn't even have bank accounts, and suddenly you had this radical reform, which meant there was demand for complex savings products, and the capital market developed from there.
Do you think there are similarities between the UK and Chile in the sense of, if you think back to, one example I like to go back to is the fact that this country used to regulate the price of a chocolate biscuit, right? Ted Heath was the one who got rid of the retail price maintenance, I think it was the RPM, that said that the state should not decide how much a chocolate biscuit should cost and actually let the market decide that. We've forgotten about these sorts of things, and in a way in which things that we take for granted today were in the realm of the state in the 70s. Are there similarities in that sense? And you think that's where the Guardians got it completely wrong?
Yes, in that sense, that is absolutely comparable. And they had this price control department, which they phased out. I think even most Guardian readers nowadays wouldn't want the state to control the price mm-hmm. of chocolate bars.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they would for nanny state purposes. That's, yes. that's a different issue altogether. But they wouldn't want price controls for staples, for groceries. That's just a very 1970s idea. But that's sometimes what happens. That I remember I had a friend at King's College who always portrayed, was always very proud of how much he hated Margaret Thatcher, especially after she died. And he would post all over social media how happy he was about that. And one day I asked him, okay, which specific reforms of the Thatcher period would you reverse if you could? And other than one fairly niche trade union act, he couldn't actually name anything. It was more that in his mind, she stood for pure evil, everything that was wrong with the country. But when I asked him specific questions about policies, I remember asking him, would you renationalize British Airways? He said, oh, come on, no, that's a totally absurd idea. Would you bring back coal mining today? Is all those specific reforms? He also said, no, I wouldn't do that. But in the end, even he would simply maintain that he hates the package, even though there's nothing in the package, the individual components, he would be okay with.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that seems to be going on in Chile as mm-hmm. well, that... the pension reform, that I'm sure you can find people who would say that should be reversed, should be renationalized. But most of the things, the opening up the economy to external trade, phasing out the kind of cronyist industrial policies they had, even most Guardian readers, I guess, even when pressed, wouldn't say, yes, I want to bring that back.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just... they hate the idea of liberalization,
yeah.
And since that was a self-conscious liberalization project, they would still feel obliged to emphasize how much they hate the Chicago Boys and think of them as pure evil.
So you might say that some on the left, the very people that attack Chile and the Chicago Boys quite vociferously, are those who are readily... willing to accept the reforms that actually did take place when they actually start to think about specific policies. But you can't get away from the fact, can you, Christian, that Pinochet was a brutal dictator, and that The Guardian do have a point when they say, how could liberals possibly accept such a regime? You know, how can a liberal defend that legacy today? And I mean, especially when it's a legacy that relied on... a dictator, well, rule by dictatorship, as anti-capitalists such as it's Naomi Klein claims, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair point. And there were people at the time on the right who tried to make excuses for the human rights violations that occurred and even afterwards. And that's a massive mistake. That's something that liberals absolutely shouldn't do, trying to downplay the human rights abuses because we approve of the economic policies. That's the sort of thinking that we would absolutely attack if a political opponent did it. So therefore, we should police ourselves and should absolutely not engage in anything of that kind. So there can be no doubt that this was a brutal dictatorship. They killed up to 3,000 people. They imprisoned and tortured opponents. They had a policy of forced exiles, of expelling people from the country. That's legacy of that is still around today. You get a Chilean diaspora all around the world because of that. So that is, of course, something that you cannot cancel out by good economic policies.
Mm-hmm.
There can be no trading off one against the other. It's true that Chile is a relatively rich country today, but of course that doesn't help the people who were killed in that period or their family members. You can't balance one against the other. I mean, just imagine a politician said to you, look, here's my plan. I'm going to kill a member of your family, but you're also going to get economic growth rates of 7% or so. That doesn't sound like a kind
of trade. Readily accept. No.
yeah, exactly. And that's why one shouldn't go down that road that as some people did at the time. And Margaret Thatcher was the most prominent example of this. She went beyond just saying, yeah, the economic policies were fine. She actually did defend Pinochet. And that on that she was wrong. Even though Margaret Thatcher is one of my political heroes, it's fair to say that when she was wrong about something, she was really wrong.
Yes.
And that was one of those cases. Nonetheless, I'd say we have to separate quite strictly between the dictatorship as such and the human rights abuses they committed and the economic policies, in the sense that there were military dictatorships at that time all over the world, and particularly in Latin America. Most of them didn't liberalize. Mm-hmm. So you can't claim that these two things absolutely go hand in hand, because a military dictatorship that accepts economic liberalization is actually the exception and not the norm. Many others didn't do that. I mean, the reason why we remember this until today is because this was so unusual. And I know a lot of people on the left would claim that you can't cherry pick in that way, that you say, okay, here's one box which you label economic policies good, and here's the other box that you label human rights abuses bad. A lot of people on the left would say you can't separate them in that way. Actually, they do it, and they are perfectly capable of doing that when we're talking about a regime whose social policies they approve of. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people on the left would praise the Cuban healthcare system. Mm-hmm. Owen Jones wrote an article a few years ago praising the healthcare system in Cuba. Now, if you said to him, oh, so you're making excuses for Castro locking up dissidents, he would say, no, I'm not saying that. And he would take offense at that insinuation, and he would be right. And he doesn't do it. He says very explicitly in the same article that that Cuba is a dictatorship, that he doesn't defend that, but that the healthcare system is nonetheless good. So they are perfectly capable of making that distinction when it is a regime where they approve of the social and economic policies. It's just that when it comes to Chile, suddenly that no longer holds.
Yeah. I mean, there is this longing, isn't there, by some commentators on the left for the sort of halcyon days of the 1970s socialist experiment in Chile.
Yes.
It's hugely popular even today, isn't it, by some Western intellectuals. I want you to explain, Christian, what was so special about Chile's version of socialism? Was it real socialism? And what do you think it would have worked had there not been the military dictatorship that got rid of this experiment in the first place?
Yeah, it's true. It remains hugely popular today. Allende remains widely seen as a kind of saintly figure. I think the reason is fairly simple. Socialist projects always go through this initial period during which Western intellectuals are absolutely mesmerized by them. This can last for a decade, maybe a bit more, but never much more than that. Then those projects always turn sour. Then you get an economic downturn. You get the regime turning authoritarian because they need to find a scapegoat for the economic decline. And you get people fleeing the country, you get refugees turning up, and socialist projects always become an embarrassment if they go on for long enough. But you always get this initial period, this honeymoon period, during which Western intellectuals wax lyrical over mm-hmm. them. Now, there are a few examples of socialist projects that came to an end forcibly before they could turn into an embarrassment. Now, when that happens, then this positive impression that people have of them in the early stages gets frozen in time. It gets preserved in aspic. It stays that way forever. It would be the equivalent of a rock star who dies at a young age, and people always remember them the way they were in their best years, like Kurt Cobain. Mm-hmm. So you could say Salvador Allende is the Kurt Cobain of socialism. In a sense that if Kurt Cobain was alive today, well, he wouldn't have stayed the way he was in 94. He might now have a massive beer belly. He might be appearing in cheesy commercials for insurance companies to stay relevant. Who knows? Maybe he would have said something politically incorrect and would have gotten cancelled. It's that since he is no longer around, he didn't have the opportunity to get anything wrong and embarrass his former fans. And yeah, therefore he's always remembered the way he was in his prime, and that's what also happened with Chilean socialism. It was ended just in time so that it got preserved in collective memory as this legend that can never die before it could turn sour. But there is, it's a bit odd that. It would be a bit odd for a socialist to say, yeah, okay, all the examples where socialism has lasted for longer all turned horribly wrong at some time. But this one example, this would have worked. And in particular, it was already falling apart. It was in 1973, there were already massive food shortages. They had an inflation rate of 500% or so. And there were already clashes between protesters and government supporters, so a quasi-civil war breaking out. It was already like Venezuela
That was going to be my next question,
right. Yeah,
Christian.
Go on then.
You've segued quite nicely onto the next question. I wonder if you... Because you mentioned Cuba, and if you compare Cuba with other countries, even if you compare Venezuela with Chile, for example, where they genuinely did try socialism, why do you think Western intellectuals cannot see these actual real-life models and apply them to the economic theory behind them, which clearly has not worked? Every single time socialism has been tried, it has been a complete and utter disaster. For the people on the left, these Western intellectuals say that they want to be the champions for. Why is there this complete lack of looking at the evidence when it comes to these socialist regimes?
It's motivated reasoning. If you have an emotional attachment to a theory, you can always somehow find reasons to persuade yourself that if you just did it a bit differently under different circumstances, it would have worked. And in the Chilean case, the case of Chilean socialism, early 70s, Allende, well, we can't definitively prove that it would have turned into a disaster. I think I'm convinced that it would have, because it was already falling apart, and because they did the same thing that Venezuela did in the Chavez years. Mm-hmm. And if you do the same thing, why would you expect different results? It was the sort of... I mean, it's true that this was a democratically elected socialist government.
Yeah.
It was not a coup or anything. But like Chavez as well, but the policies were pretty much the same. It was extensive use of price controls causing shortages, and it was nationalizations in an ad hoc way, and undermining the rule of law, undermining the institutions of the country, which were weak already but weakened further. And that's exactly what happened in Venezuela. It's just that there, they could get away with it for a while because they did it during an oil boom. And you could say Chile under Allende was basically Venezuela without the oil, which is the reason why Chavez could get away with it for a bit over a decade. There, it was already turning into a crisis after just 2 years. So the only year in which they seemed to be doing well was the first year, just after Allende got elected. Then the last 2 years, the economy was already shrinking and shrinking at an accelerating rate. And this went on then after the coup. This is in this interim period before the Chicago Boys took over, and the military was somehow trying to manage the economy without quite knowing how to.
Mm.
That's when they had a massive economic implosion continuing from before and hitting rock bottom then. But this still has to be attributed to the Allende policies. Would have been would have ended in tears. But it would have been better, of course, if they had just let that experiment fail on its own terms, let it run its course, just to take away that excuse.
Mm-hmm.
Because as things stand, socialists will forever keep saying, there it would have worked. This is the one example that would have worked. Ideally, you would have just allowed it to fail. And who knows, maybe there would have been a democratic government that would have been amenable somewhat to Chicago Boys' economic policies.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, Christian, if to end, you can explain what, I mean, if we look back to what we said in the opening of this podcast, we said Chile used to be considered the economic poster child of Latin America, which would rather suggest it isn't seen as that anymore. I mean, I wonder if you can summarize what the differences between Venezuela and Chile are now within economic terms.
Oh yeah, that's the difference, like day and night. I mean, in absolute terms, terms of economic output per capita, Chile is now not that far behind Portugal. So they are the first Latin American country that you can reasonably describe as a fully developed first world country, the first Latin American country that has made that leap. And in terms of social indicators, life expectancy, child mortality, maternal mortality, they are indistinguishable from a developed country, from a more established industrialized country. If you just looked at the figures without knowing which country that was, you wouldn't say, oh, this is somewhere in Latin America. You would think this is somewhere in Western Europe, this is North America or Japan. And on those figures, and also literacy rates and percentage of the population with access to electricity, those sort of social indicators, they are a fully developed country in that sense. Whereas Venezuela has only been going back. They used to be the richest country in Latin America before socialism, and even during socialism, while oil prices were still colossally high. So there is that, but a big part of the reason, I guess, why Chile no longer gets that positive press is that the goalposts have shifted. I remember when I read about what was then called the miracle of Chile for the first time about 20 years ago, and for quite a while after that, Chile was always compared to its neighbor countries. Articles in the Western media would always say, look, Chile is doing so much better than Argentina. They're doing so much better than Brazil. They're doing so much better than Peru. Now, we're comparing Chile to other OECD countries. Now, that's fair. They are now an OECD country. They joined, I think, 10 years ago. But that just means they used to be a big fish in a small pond. They were compared to their neighbors, and articles would always say that they're doing so much better than their neighbors, or it would be something like, here are economic problems that are common to that region, with the exception of Chile. They would always be the ones singled out in a positive way. That's why it always seemed positive. Now you would read, Chile has the highest level of inequality in the OECD. Chile has worse public transport than other OECD countries. But we take it completely for granted that we compare them to OECD countries, to mm-hmm. developed countries. 20 years ago, this would have seemed absurd. Mm-hmm. People would have said, well, yeah, they're doing better than Argentina, they're doing better than Brazil, but of course you can't compare them to the first world. They're not there yet. Now they are more or less there. They're just not by first world standards. Yep. They are a relatively poor first world country. They are at the lower end, at the threshold still. So if you wanted to use a slightly silly analogy, when I was in my early teens, I used to do athletics competitions at the local level. At the local level, you have a fairly limited talent pool, and in comparison to the people there, I was pretty good, and I was getting a bit smug about that, telling others, I'm the fastest runner here. None of you can compete with me. And one day my trainer said to me, right, you need to go one step up. You need to do regional level competitions. And there, suddenly, I was one of the worst. They were vastly superior and much more professional. And that's more or less what happened to the Chilean economy. They were best in class by Latin American standards. But now they're an OECD economy. They are compared to OECD economies. Nothing wrong with that. They are, as I said, they are an OECD member, so why not? But we need to bear in mind that in absolute terms, they have improved massively. They mm-hmm. keep improving, but the goalposts have shifted.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, Christian. That was very interesting. Now, if you tweet us at IEA London, you can let us know whether or not you agree with everything that Christian has said in this podcast. And you can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcast, Spotify, and Podbean. For more blogs, films, and reports, you can go to the IEA website at iea.org.uk.